Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
The topic for today's podcast and next week's podcast is harmony. The Buddha said, "Although they wish to live without hatred, harming, hostility, or malignity, and in peace, yet they live in hatred, harming one another, hostile and malign." We're a social species. We live in relationship to others, occupy social roles and obligations, are in constant negotiation with one another. But our interpersonal and communal lives are all too often marked by discord, ruffled feathers, infighting, argument, insult, exploitation, violence, and war. At the same time, it's substantially within the realm of interpersonal and communal relations that the practices of generosity, harmlessness, and purity of mind that we've been discussing in previous weeks play out. As we perfect our generosity, our harmlessness, and our purity, our relationship with our fellow social beings improves. We treat them with more kindness and compassion. We take care not to step on their toes, nor harm, nor insult them. And we do what we can to help them rather than to exploit them. Imagine what the world would be like if everyone developed in this way. Nevertheless, the interpersonal or communal realm has its own peculiarities and pitfalls that most of us are slow to master. We get stuck. Fortunately, the Buddha gave us abundant wise advice about these. That is the topic of this talk. Be careful what you say. A primary conditioning factor of interpersonal and communal harmony or disharmony is how skillfully we wield the instrument of speech. The Buddha has a lot to say about this skill. We'll see later that one of the eight factors of the Buddhist path is right speech, which in particular opposes false, harsh, divisive, and frivolous speech. Here are the primary requisites for speaking skillfully in a nutshell. Bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of kindness. Possessing these five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. We notice all three systems of ethics intersect here for avoiding harm, producing beneficial consequences, and checking the purity of one's intentions all come into play. Furthermore, finding the right time and speaking gently harmonize with the delicate nature of human sensitivities. Notice also that truthfulness is a necessary but not in itself sufficient basis for speech. Our job is not to shine light in every dark corner, except in our own minds. For instance, a common in one of the most awkward social situations arises when there is need to reproach someone for doing something felt to be inappropriate or harmful. Someone is stepping on our foot, for example, or has failed to complete an agreed task, and to do this out of kindness without causing offense and in such a way that the proffered advice is actually usefully accepted. Considering the right time takes note of such things as whether a person to be admonished is now in a good or receptive mood. Sometimes a bit of friendly small talk will serve to set the mood before the topic is broached. It's good to see a familiar face. By the way, can I give you some advice based on my own years of experience on that project you're doing otherwise so splendidly? Nonetheless, many people are difficult to admonish, easily offended, and ready to fly off the handle no matter how skillfully we present the situation. If no benefit is likely to accrue, then discretion suggests saying nothing, thereby cutting our losses and preserving harmony. Significantly, the monastic code includes a rather important precept that prohibits monks or nuns from being difficult to admonish. For instance, from being argumentative or conjuring up counter-admonitions. Our practice typically makes us more thick-skinned and our egos less easily bruised, so that we begin to see admonishment as advice rather than personal attack. Nonetheless, most other people will remain quite fragile. One of the greatest dangers to communal harmony that the Buddha warns us about is speaking divisively. Rather than attempting to admonish someone for his perceived errors, this person speaks about them to others, generally in their absence, whether truthfully or falsely. Unfortunately, once unleashed, such speech is often repeated with little deliberation by others and may even go viral. Having heard something here, he repeats it elsewhere, in order to divide those people from these. Or having heard something elsewhere, he repeats it to these people, in order to divide them from these. Thus he is one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, one who enjoys factions, delights in factions, a speaker of words that create factions. Divisive speech may target individual people or entire groups of people. It can occur quite frivolously, often as an attempt at humor or wit, or it can be used in a way of building countervailing group solidarity. Many people routinely speak ill of others in an attempt to build self-esteem or to reassure themselves of their own righteousness. Increasingly, particularly with the rise of mass communications, it arises deliberately and with great precision, spreading half-truths or total fabrications as a way of controlling whole populations. Consider that racism and ethnic cleansing begin with divisive speech, and colonial empires could not have been built without the policy of divide and conquer. Divisive speech is poison to both large societies and small communities. It undermines our trust in the targeted people and populations and ultimately undermines our trust in each other. We should take great care not to divide with our speech, nor to repeat divisive speech we've heard elsewhere. Even if it happens to be true, the potential for harm in communicating to those of ignoble intent can be great. The error of retribution. Much of natural human behavior is based on reciprocation. Friendship is reciprocated. Our economy is based on the principle of mutually agreeable exchange. It's not surprising that our natural response when someone harms us is retaliation. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is a pervasive ethic to this day. Much of American criminal justice, not to mention foreign policy, is based on retaliation. Nonetheless, Buddhist ethics is different. Recall that generosity is not pure if some kind of payback is expected, and an equal exchange is two missed opportunities for merit-making. harmlessness is practiced toward all living beings across the board, just as the mental qualities of renunciation and kindness are not selective. We don't exclude some as not deserving the benefit of our pure intentions. This makes our practice simple. Our job is to embody generosity, harmlessness, and kindness toward all others in all circumstances, regardless of how they behave. Their practice is their own, ours is our own. We cannot do it for them. The closest we can come is to inspire them through our example. The Dhammapada wisely states in this regard, "Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By kindness alone is hatred appeased. This is a law eternal." Hatred is both cause and result of abuse, where hatred is a flame, bringing more hatred to bear only adds fuel to the fire. Yet this is how foolish people almost invariably think and behave. Kindness is that which seeks benefit and is therefore most capable of correcting disharmony. He practices for the welfare of both his own and the others. When, knowing that his foe is angry, he mindfully maintains his peace. The famous simile of the saw presents one of the most strikingly gruesome of the Buddha's images. Through this vivid image, the Buddha challenges us to give up the error of retribution even under the most challenging circumstances. Monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hatred towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. We should, in brief, do everything we can in our effort to maintain harmony, even in the most adverse conditions. Anger, a kind of hatred, is the great retributive emotion and one of the primary and most immediate conditions of disharmony. There is no wisdom in anger. It knows only one thing. Yet many of us are so afflicted by anger that ridding ourselves of its grip becomes a primary focus in our practice. In one of the Buddha's discourses, he describes three kinds of persons. The first is like a line etched in stone. He gets angry, and anger persists for a long time. The second is like a line etched in the ground. He gets angry, but his anger erodes quickly. The third, and this is what we should aspire to be, is like a line etched in water. Even if spoken to harshly, he does not anger, but remains on friendly terms with, mingles with, and greets the one who would make the first two types of people angry. The last has the mind most conducive to harmony. We are inclined to reserve our most virulent anger for fellow humans. We do not, for instance, generally get angry at gravity or rain, no matter how implicated these may be in our personal hardships. Yet even a hint of disrespect or an unskillful word from a human can put us into instant rage. Anger also has a tipping point past which the object of our vexation becomes dehumanized, demonized, becomes, at least temporarily, for the same person might paradoxically at other times be one of our dearest friends, a source of irredeemable evil, rather than a conditioned complex of pleasing virtues and vexing faults like the rest of us. This is the great delusion anger evokes. Anger is a conditioned response that can be unlearned as part of purification of mind. However, there are also a number of reflections or thought experiments that many might find useful in this regard. The Buddha suggests that we put ourselves in the shoes of others by fully recognizing our common humanity, our suffering, our desire for happiness. He points out, in view of anger's karmic implications, that in responding with anger, we're doing to ourselves just what our most ill-intentioned foe would want for us. In the end, we should be able to echo Sariputta's lion's roar, spoken to the Buddha. Just as they throw pure and impure things on the earth, feces, urine, spittle, pus, and blood, and yet the earth is not repelled, humiliated, or disgusted because of this, so too, Bhante, I dwell with a mind like earth, vast, exalted, and measureless, without enmity and ill will. This is how we learn to harmonize in a disharmonious world. Respect. Another condition for harmony in the Buddha's teaching is respect. The larger ascetic tradition to which the Buddha and Buddhism belonged in ancient India quite readily rejected prevailing cultural norms, as often did the Buddha. The ascetic tradition could sometimes also be raucous and disrespectful. The Buddha was different. He placed great emphasis on the social lubricants of courtesy, etiquette, and respect. The Sangha met with mutual respect was expected to meet in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, while blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes, and to adjourn in harmony. A large part of the monastic code consists of rules of etiquette. The attention Buddhist monastics characteristically give to proper attire and grooming, in contrast to matted hair ascetics, is a further example. Respect has two aspects, mental attitude and physical or verbal expression. The attitude of respect is at its base to regard something or someone as mattering, to keep in mind the value of something or somebody. Literally, the English word respect means see again. It's what we do when we refuse to dehumanize or demonize someone who annoys us. There's wisdom in respect. We don't have to agree with someone or find them agreeable to respect them as a human, someone who is, in the most essential respects, just like us. It's easy to appreciate that respect can contribute to harmony. And, as a matter of fact, as we practice non-harming and develop qualities of kindness towards living beings, we find we naturally come to respect them more and more. As we respect them more, it becomes harder for us to harm them, feel anger toward them, or speak divisively about them. In fact, respect puts to rest the dehumanizing quality of anger discussed earlier. The most basic physical expression of respect in India was and still is placing one's palms together in Anjali, much like the Christian prayer posture. The fact that Anjali has been preserved in all the diverse Asian cultures into which Buddhism has been transmitted indicates the importance accorded to respect, just as practicing ethically toward living beings encourages respect for them, acknowledging people and even things through physical expression encourages a respectful attitude toward them. This coming together of attitude and expression is not unfamiliar to us in the West, though perhaps not so ubiquitous as in Indian or in Buddhist culture. A handshake, a hug, or a wave is also an expression that engenders or amplifies related attitudes of mind. The famous Sigalowada Sutta tells of a young man, Sigala, the son of a householder, who rises early in the morning, leaves town with wet clothes and wet hair, and then bows to the east, the south, the west, the north, up and down. Then the Buddha comes along with a valuable lesson for young Sigala. Then the exalted one, having robed himself in the forenoon, took bowl and robe and entered Rajagaha for alms. Now he saw young Sigala worshipping thus and spoke to him as follows. Wherefore do you, young householder, rising early in the morning, departing from Rajagaha with wet clothes and wet hair, worship with joined hands these various quarters, the east, the south, the west, the north, the nadir, and the zenith? My father, Lord, when dying, said to me, the six quarters, dear son, you shall worship. And I, Lord, respecting, revering, and honoring my father's word, rise up early in the morning and leave Rajagaha with wet clothes and wet hair, worship with joined hands these six quarters. It is not thus, young householder, that the six quarters should be worshipped in the discipline of the noble ones. How then, Lord, should the six quarters be worshipped in the discipline of the noble ones? It is well, Lord, if the exalted one would teach the doctrine to me, showing how the six quarters should be worshipped in the discipline of the noble ones. The following should be looked at as the six quarters. The parents should be looked upon as the east, teachers as the south, wife and children as the west, friends and associates as the north, servants and employees as the nadir, ascetics and Brahmins as the zenith. Now, although Sigala's practice was motivated by respect for his father and involved a lot of bowing, the six quarters toward which Sigala was bowing had no particular significance for him. The physical respect was present, but the mental attitude eluded him. The Buddha's reply is a primary example of the Buddha's giving a non-Buddhist conceptual scheme a Buddhist interpretation. In this case, turning that which to Sigala was an empty ritual into a valuable teaching about living harmoniously and responsibly in the world. The Buddha provided an interpretation of each of the six quarters as a distinct social relation that would, or at least should, matter to him. And the Buddha did not stop there, as we will see next week. Deference is a kind of respect that bestows some degree of authority or elevated status to the other. Degrees of deference in ascending order are reverence, homage, veneration, and worship. We find veneration for the Buddha himself quite clearly expressed physically in the early sources through full prostrations, sometimes touching the Buddha's feet, by circumambulation while keeping the Buddha on one's right, by covering one's otherwise bare shoulder with one's robe, by sitting on a lower seat than the Buddha, by standing when the Buddha would enter the room, by walking behind the Buddha or not turning one's back to the Buddha, and by use of proper forms of address. In Western culture, deference is expressed through the title Sir, Your Honor, Doctor, etc. Most European languages, but not English, have different forms of the pronoun for you to underscore deference, such as German du versus sie or French tu versus vous. The military salutes according to rank. Deference harmonizes human relations in two ways. First, it makes us subject to the influence of another. We cannot learn from a teacher, for example, that we do not respect, and we learn all the more quickly from a teacher that we revere or venerate. Deference opens channels of non-coercive authority through which wisdom flows. The Buddha asked that monastics not bother teaching those who fail to show deference. Second, deference helps us develop humility by knocking the ego out of its accustomed position at the center of the universe. It also undercuts the tendency in groups of people to compete for authority. We'll have more to say about respect and deference in the context of refuge in future talks.